Hello and welcome to Minor Wrecks. I'm Dave. I'm here with Joel and Jamie and Tony, and we're talking about science books today and space-themed books today because we have a space-themed summer reading club going on at Des Plaines Public Library. If you haven't come out yet, you definitely should. We've got kids and teens and adult stuff to do. You can vote in the Star Slam. You can spin the wheel and get a prize. You can read books. You can enter trivia contests, all sorts of things. So if you live in Des Plaines or near Des Plaines, come on by and see what we got going on. And it is a space-themed event, so we read space-themed books or science-themed books. And I read The Demon-Haunted World by Carl Sagan. I'll start us off. And it's a fascinating book, mostly because it was written in 1995, and it felt like it was written yesterday. It's quite prescient about the way the world works now, and I can't believe in 95, Carl Sagan was picking up on these themes that have come crashing down on us from social media and the internet and the way people think about science and scientists. But anyway, it is a book about how to view science. And his main point is it's not about a knowledge base. It's not a list of facts. It's about how you think. It's about critical thinking. It's about skepticism. It's about proving your hypotheses. It's not about, well, I read all these facts, therefore I know better than you. I'm a scientist. And it's about applying the scientific theory to everyday life. It's called The Demon-Haunted World. And he says, in The Demon-Haunted World, science is like a candle in the darkness. You know, it's our one source of light that we can kind of explore where we are and figure out what these forces are that surround us on all sides. He has a lot of great metaphors and analogies about how to think of certain arguments and certain problems. I remember the one about the dragon in the garage. You know, he's got all these great little phrases. And the dragon in the garage is like, let's say I have a dragon in my garage. And you're like, cool, I want to come see it. I'm like, sure, come on by. And I open up my garage door and there's nothing there. And you're like, well, where's the dragon? I say, well, he's invisible. Well, that's all right. You know, if he's invisible, I could get an infrared camera and see your dragon, right? And I was like, well, he also produces no heat. He's magic. I was like, oh, well, then, you know, if I throw some sawdust in the air, it'll fall upon him. It's like, well, no, he's very small and floats around. It's hard to find him. At the end of the day, what have I proven? And Carl Sagan says, nothing. I've proven nothing. I've proven absolutely nothing about my dragon. But it kind of feels like I have. You might think, oh, yeah, all right, that makes sense. And people fall for this all the time. Not with a dragon, a magical, invisible, flying, tiny dragon, but with arguments on the internet or on Twitter or in your homes or with your friends. If someone denies you enough times, you think, oh, they must be right. When in fact, no one's proven anything. It's a total dud of a conversation. And you should continue to be skeptical of that claim that I have a dragon in my garage.
Yeah, that reminds me of some part of the book I read for today. The book I read was The Cosmic Cocktail, Three Parts Dark Matter by Catherine Freese, a theoretical physicist. And there's a part about halfway in the book where they actually start, she talks about the Large Hadron Collider particle accelerator and how there was this big uproar in the news and a viral, in a lot of sense, a viral uproar that people thought it was going to cause tiny black holes to open and it would destroy the Earth.
I do remember that.
Yes. Yeah, and I think there was even a spoof on The Daily Show about, not a spoof, but an actual conversation between two of the disagreeing parties to show kind of how the actual debate, when you just bring it into a room and start talking about it, is kind of loses its meaning when you just two people in a room talking about it, not looking at evidence or not looking at results.
Sure.
Things like that. So The Cosmic Cocktail is actually, interestingly, about stuff that doesn't exist in the way that we understand it. It's very much a dragon type of thing because it's kind of about dark matter. It's kind of about, of all the things that our universe is made out of, the cosmos is made out of. This book and the author repeatedly tells us in this book that it's actually only 5% atomic matter. The, the atomic matter that we're used to is really only 5% of all matter in the universe. And it's really fascinating how Freese will actually take the small steps to give you the evidence you need to illustrate this picture from, like, basically doing this cosmic microwave background measurement of radiation from telescopes that can see as far as we are capable of seeing to basically draw a map and to make conclusions that all kind of rely on each other in some ways that help predict actually how much is dark matter. And the reason it's actually that coupled with like light refraction, the way that light is bending, because there's a massive object that you can't see, therefore it's dark. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That light refraction coupled with the knowledge of the way the universe is, I guess, either shaped or how it expands. And I'm only gradually approaching even understanding this, but how that actually leads you to the existence of dark matter, not to say that we even know what it is. So it's really interesting, and it is kind of funny when you think about it, because as I'm reading this, there are moments of, oh, that's so cool, and oh, that's so big, and that's such a big number, and why, and like that actually makes sense, but I still don't understand the big picture. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that science also has to tell us, is that there are some certainties we can glean from facts about certain aspects of, you know, reality, or, you know, in this case, like, what is the physical reality even made out of? Mm-hmm. You know, it's still only a piece of a picture. And I think that the author really acknowledges that as often as she repeats herself and says 5% mass, roughly 25% dark matter. And mm-hmm. then there's a lot of other stuff out there called dark energy, which I haven't even gotten to that part of the book. I don't know that I should have, because it would have been impossible to explain it in a 20-minute podcast.
So what is dark matter to your understanding? I guess the follow-up question to this is like, how accessible did you feel like the explanations were to, you mm-hmm. know, an average lay person?
I think it was actually a pretty dense book mm-hmm. that helped disguise the, because Catherine Freese is like a very serious player in this world in terms of actually being one of the people to move the field forward in her research. So she's writing on a very dense topic, but mm-hmm. she's trying to bring it into a personal realm by just telling you more about the people that made the discoveries. Mm-hmm. And so to answer your question about like what dark matter is, I feel like I shouldn't feel stupid to not be able to answer that, because I've read like roughly half of the book, and chapter 5 is titled What is Dark Matter? And I'm like halfway through that one. I feel like, no, it's not really broken down very well. Okay. And that's my one of my major criticisms of the book. Mm-hmm. But it's also like there's a lot of puzzle pieces that you have to stack up really neatly mm-hmm. to understand where you're at that point by the time you get there. A large way that it's described is like by what it isn't. Mm-hmm. And so like a lot of things is like, well, it doesn't emit light, but we know that mass has to cause this. There's something that has to be massive, but it doesn't interact with matter. Like if I were to touch this microphone stand, like, obviously, my hand is made of matter, and that's matter. So it's like they call the particles WIMPs, which is like weak interactions, massive particles. So they're still massive in that they have gravitational pull, mm-hmm. but they're particles that don't interact with mass as we know it, or matter as we mm-hmm. know it, regular atomic matter. So that's the best explanation that I can give you in like a pithy phrase. But it's cool because it defines it on a lot of what people guessed and how they were kind of proven wrong. And that's more of how they got to like what dark matter isn't first. So it's pretty neat. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think she does a good job of like doing honor to the people that she didn't necessarily agree with, acknowledging that there's going to be a lot of many camps of science, that they're all existing in this world and fighting a good fight. And I don't know, there's a lot of eccentric players too. So this is, when I was reading like media about this book, it sounded like it was more of a personal story, and that there were sprinkles of like mm-hmm. her own journey. And that's true, but it's very, very minimal. It's a very sciencey book. Hmm. So if you're into that, then I suggest it.
Yeah, one of the great things I'm seeing is that everyone's book has like a library sticker on the spine. We all, you know, these books, which are beyond my understanding mm-hmm. as a non-scientist, are here and available. And I can, you know, give it an honest try to understand the big questions of the world. I'm kind of loving that accessibility, mm-hmm. that even though I'm not going to understand everything in Tony's book, and I'm not equipped to understand everything in Tony's book, but it should still be there. It mm-hmm. should still be available to anyone that wants to check it out, right? And I'm feeling really good about the fourth floor right now.
Yeah, I think the one really strong point of the book that I read, which was Brief Answers to the Big Questions by Stephen Hawking, which came out last year, is how accessible it was. And I've picked up, you know, those books that label themselves as like pop physics or something in the past that are supposedly for the layperson, like 7 Brief Lessons in Physics, things like that, where I read that whole book because it was small and I had no idea what was happening in the whole thing. But this book, and I think what Stephen Hawking, why he was so beloved by people, is just he brings this humanity to astrophysics and cosmology and all these subjects that are, you know, literally out of this world, like so intangible. But because of his personality and the way that he writes about it and talks about his life and brings that into questions like, what is inside a black hole? And yet he's also making jokes and riffing on experiences with his kids. It really centers it. And this book, it made me feel like I understood Stephen Hawking a little better, but even I understood you know, black holes a little better in a way that other books did not teach me about. And I think what I got out of this in questions like, should we colonize space? Can we predict the future? He divided the book into 10 different questions, and each question has an answer, you know, a brief answer to a big question like, will we survive on Earth? But he starts out from this macro view, and then he goes into the micro of breaking it down into little pieces of physics and little bits of science, but not in a way that is so dense to be overwhelming. It's still broad enough where it's like, okay, this is like on a Wikipedia page level where I am kind of understanding what's happening, but written in a really good way. But clearly, he is so smart and isn't one of those people who's just trying to pull out these words and terms and jargon that we won't understand, that he understands in such a comprehensive way to make it feel like, oh, this is someone who's clearly loved what he was talking about, loved what he was studying, and is trying to kind of talk about that with other people. And you'll notice when I'm talking about this, I'm not talking about anything like specifically because it's still beyond like what I still can comprehend. But in things like, should we colonize space? His answer was vehemently yes, because that is the way we will propagate our future society because we are destroying our planet very quickly. So he was like, yes, we should colonize space. And I was like, oh.
I was wondering about, you know, will we be able to exist on Earth? That was the answer to that question.
Yes. He was very, you know, what I got out of this book was his optimism, like his optimism in humanity and our ability to triumph. Not that he's saying it won't be difficult, because it will be difficult. And, you know, he was talking about how we're kind of dumb, you know, with the choices that we're making. But if we can make those changes, we can survive and move forward with things like, oh, we have to go to other planets and things like that. So I just felt like, if you liked the movie A Theory of Everything, you know, and if that's your only entrance point right now to Stephen Hawking or things like this, this is pretty much, you know, like not too far off the level of that movie. Like if you understood that movie, you can read this book and be delighted by it, because I was delighted by it, even though if you asked me like 5 things I know about physics now, I wouldn't be able to tell you. But I can say that I was very interested in it.
Sounds really similar to the book that I read, authored by Bill Nye, called Undeniable, and it is not with the N-Y-E. It's with the D-E-N-I-A. But Undeniable, Evolution and the Science of Creation, written in 2014. And again, it's very accessible science. It's a sense of theme here of huge ideas being brought down to piecemeal, not in a negative context, but so that people can understand and integrate that into their lives. And the main part of this book is explaining evolution. It's based on a debate that he had with a creationist. And basically it branches off from the lecture that he gave on as his side of the debate, as why is evolution is more believable than creation. In this case, creation being the fact that Earth was created 10,000 years ago based on biblical perspectives. But he starts off with that and talks about the beauty of science being involved in evolution and the scientific evidence that the Earth is, in fact, 4.5 billion years old. Just talks about evolution in that context, but then he takes it from beyond our normal world and kind of extrapolates to what it would mean to have life on other planets. He identifies a few areas in our solar system that have water vapor coming off of the moon. There's a moon of Jupiter and a moon of Saturn that have water vapor coming off. And something as simple as designing a spacecraft to fly by and get water on the windscreen. And then they'll identify biological and see if there's any biological matter on that. It's just as simple as that. And he is, Bill Nye is the president of the Planetary Society. The Planetary Society is currently in production of a solar sail to help power future spacecraft of not just you know, a solar panel, but just collecting enough energy to power to extend beyond our local neighborhood of the solar system. So it was a big book. It discussed a lot. It had that interstellar aspect to it, but it also just took a realistic viewpoint of some things from the Bible as far as, you know, if Noah really did have an ark and it ended up on the top of Mount Ararat in Turkey, and had 2 of every animal, then how did kangaroos get from there back to Australia? And why did nobody ever, like, report seeing these weird things hopping all the way across? So it was just, it had a lot of humor injected into it. But the other major part of this book was his passion that he had. It's filled with phrases that end a lot of chapters. For instance, so please think big and think critically. just exhorting people to not only understand and learn from this book, but to go forth and maybe write a book of their own on some undiscovered aspect of science. And he would love to see people pass by him and go into the future and discover more. And I thought that was a really interesting aspect of the book.
Yeah, I think it sounds like the way that your two individual science books, like, almost, they're talking about like science as a tool almost to reinterpret some of the stories, right, that we're telling, but also to write the next ones, right? I like the idea of, like, a solar sail sounds, you know, science fiction, but that it's something that's in that book is very powerful. And I think that that might be kind of what he's alluding to, is like, you can take this and you can go further than I'm going. And that's kind of what science is. It's building on the people that came before.
And this was, like, just from the looking at the Planetary Society website, it was developed by Carl Sagan 3 decades ago. And he was going to talk about it with Johnny Carson, but for some reason the show was canceled. But that was going to be the introduction of the solar sail and just the evolution of the idea. And that science is factual, and it's based on, it's easy to follow, you know, where people have gone before, so that other people can pick up and move forward with that when faced with big questions of, you know, where are we? What are we doing to our planet? You know, where can we go from here? And should we?
Yeah.
And the last chapter in my book is actually called How Do We Shape the Future? So it really is talking about, like, what his hopes are for the future. The paragraph that I liked the most in this book, I'll just read this quote, is where he's talking about that he feels like all kids should have some basis in science. Not that they all should be scientists, but should have a general knowledge. His conclusion from that is, a world where only a tiny super elite are capable of understanding advanced science and technology and its applications would be, to my mind, a dangerous and limited one. I seriously doubt whether long-range beneficial projects such as cleaning up the oceans or curing diseases in the developing world would be given priority. Worse, we could find that technology is used against us and that we might have no power to stop it. And he was just talking about, because, like, if I think of, you know, elite scientists, he's one of the most well-known, most elite, you know, people that we all thought of as being, you know, the scientists, but he's advocating in kind of a egalitarian view that we all need to be involved in science in some way or others. Otherwise, you know, it's just going to be turning towards more things like eugenics and stuff like that instead of all these other great projects that he was talking about. So I really liked that.
Or it's, as Tony put it, as a tool. I mean, if it's a tool that we can use to increase our world, then that tool should be in more hands and
exactly.
not fewer.
Yeah.
Well, and as we were talking about before, a major place to come and do that, obviously, is school, but also, not to toot our own horn, but the library.
Yeah.
You know, where you can access any subject you're interested in, scientific or not, and to go forward and to learn from that. So that's one of the purposes of the library, is to make that happen.
And our ability to have, like, Wi-Fi access and the internet and just how much information exchange can happen through the internet at such an unprecedented pace, and how that can just help us evolve more and more. Yeah.
And one of the facts in here that I thought was really pertinent to this discussion, which is, like, not a typical, like, trivia piece, but she took a good page to explain it, is what does understanding our place in the cosmos in this giant thing have to affect our lives? Well, it turns out, I think it was during the I was mentioning the Large Hadron Collider. It was during the development of one of these particle accelerators that there was so much data, and the data would, before it had to be stored somewhere and retrieved, like, manually. So, like, actually part of the innovation of getting scientific data to people was actually part of the birth of the World Wide Web.
Sure.
So it's like, right there, like, just in our desire to share these discoveries with more people and to actually apply the data that we're collecting in some meaningful way, that's actually one of the innovations of our age. And I think that, like, what else were we going to unlock in this process if that's just the start, you know?
Sure.
They also said that so much data is being collected, harvested, that, like, we're only using a small fraction that we imagine to be useful. I found that to be really interesting, too.
But. The water vapor spouting off of the moons was just figured out last year. And they were able to extrapolate that from information taken by, I think, the Galileo spacecraft that flew by a decade and a half ago.
Oh.
Collected all this information.
They didn't know what to do with it.
And they were able to take that information and pair it with telescope images and kind of put the two together and see what happened. And they were able to combine the information. They can't. That must be a a vapor spout.
That's amazing.
So
blows my mind that that data has just been sitting in a file for decades, and just now it's getting applied, and they're figuring out like how to use it and how to interpret it.
You just get this vision of a scientist say, "Wait a minute," and roll his chair back and pull something off and flip through, and here it is.
Yeah, it really does make me feel as if almost like science and, like you were saying, the library, or like science and communities really have a place like to grow. We have like we have so much to cultivate there, because everybody has their own unique take and their own unique interpretation of the way things might fit together, that it should be almost advertised like open data and the type of observations we're making, and actually give them a little bit of meaning and context, because I'm not going to understand what this the cosmic microwave background chart means. But it, maybe if like someone were to explain the basics of it to me, then I could see how it fits into my theories or the theories that they that the pervading theories.
Well, even in the academic world, there's a huge debate about journals being published within like different conglomerates that you have to pay for, or you know, open source. And a lot of professors and a lot of researchers are pushing for open source to just to help further the information.
Yeah, because otherwise it's just all these articles that 30 people are reading just locked up in an ivory tower where, you know, if we can build on each other's work in a, you know, accessible way. And I think it's so cool for younger people, like things like STEM is so integrated into learning and into school in a way that doesn't seem like, oh, it's this separate thing.
My kid came home from school last week with some sort of pinwheel and whatever. And I thought it was just some sort of craft. And he was like, "No, Dad, watch." And he spun it and it wound up. It had a purpose behind it. And it was this whole thing. And he was explaining it to me. And that was just, that was a good moment.
And it's about inspiration and hoping that leads to fresh takes, right? Like, you want to inspire kids and you want to inspire adults who can inspire other adults or inspire their own children. And, you know, that just goes on and on. That's what you want. You don't know who you could inspire that could interpret that data or dedicate themselves to a scientific pursuit. You know, having that information is good. Having these viewpoints is good. These scientific informed viewpoints of being skeptical, but being curious at the same time, being open, but careful and serious.
Disciplined.
Yes, absolutely. As opposed to you read something on Facebook and you assume it's true, and half the people don't realize it came from The Onion and it's a joke, right? And, I mean, that's one thing, but then it can get more insidious than that sometimes. So always be skeptical. Always check your sources and then check those sources. And that's just going to lead to a better life if you have that skepticism, have that seriousness about the information that's available to you.
Yeah, especially as we're talking about, there is so much data, there's so much information available to us, and it's so hard, unless we're taking this critical eye, as you were saying, to not look and be like, was this from a peer-reviewed study? You know, is this from, you know, just two people just making something up? And I think that's super important with all our social media and the fact that so many people get news and information that way. But my younger sister, who's a computer engineer, was like, "When your daughter turns three, I'm going to buy her a circuit set for her birthday." I was like, I still now don't really understand what a circuit is, but it's so cool that they have things like that available from such a young age
to
instill this,
to
instill this love for it. And in all these type of people that traditionally didn't have access to scientific communities or institutions. So,
yeah. And I think honestly, this, like, I feel semi-accomplished just for even like approaching a book that's a little bit more intimidating than something, you know, and I feel like I owe a huge debt to like just the education I received and just like being around sci-fi TV and movies and media, but also like people that are fascinated with some of this stuff in high school. And just, I feel like it's an edge, and we can like, you can make science actually kind of something that is cool to do. You know, it's not like, it seems like it's, they've tried that before. Bill Nye tried that. He's still trying it. But I think now is a great time to do it. And now is a great time to succeed in doing that, because it's one of the good, solid ways of like maintaining some, at least, like we were talking about, like truth or some agency over what, like how we test our hypothesis, you know, how we can prove things.
It's also a lot like exercise too, you know, where you might get complacent or, you know, might get flabby in the brain. But like, when you read stuff that you have to critically think about, and it helps sharpen and hone that portion of your head. For me, like now I try to write reviews on Goodreads books, just to try to help why did I like this mm-hmm. book, and how would I describe it, and what would it be read-alike for, mm-hmm. and, which is good because we're in Reader's Advisory. So,
and I think it's going back to sci-fi. I'm the sci-fi guy, so I'm going to give a little speech here. But, you know, the books are intended to make you question yourself and your place and your world mm-hmm. and your society, sometimes very broadly and sometimes specifically. Like, you know, Heinlein wrote a book called Have Spacesuit, Will Travel. Mm-hmm. It's about a young woman who finds a spacesuit and goes to space and meets aliens, and all that's a lot of fun. But then along the way, he describes how the spacesuit works and why. And I learned how a spacesuit works and why it works the way it does, not from a nonfiction book, but from a fiction book, because that's how he told his story. Ringworld talks about great devices in space that could harness the energy of the sun. And along the way, it's a wonderful little story, but some books actually teach, like, this is the real science behind it. Mm-hmm. This is what we're really doing. And others speculate. This is what could be happening. You know, are we really going to go to other planets, you and me, actual human beings? Or are robots going to get there first? Well, robots made it to Mars, and we didn't. So I guess, you know, someone's a little saw ahead and understood that.
Yeah. Or, you know, are we alone in our own dimension, or are there more dimensions, going back to our discussion of PKD and the Man in the High Castle?
Yeah, sure.
I was happy to read that this one cosmologist and physicist believes not in the multiverse. And I was like, thankfully, that does not complicate things more for me. And I can just keep reading this book.
It's so much worse.
Yeah, it'd make everything worse, yeah.
Because I remember PKD did a comparison. He thought God would try on a universe out of a coat closet. And that's the image that he had. We'll do this universe today.
Yeah, talk about, you know, rethinking your assumptions about the universe.
Right. But that's the beauty of it. Like, we can speculate all we want, but then if there's some data that makes someone tap their head and say, wait a minute, what does this mean?
Sure.
How does this fit in? So,
could this really work? Could I really do this? Mm-hmm. Could we really do this?
And how can this be interpreted?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How much more data is there that it can be found that's still being stored? Mm-hmm. We keep coming back to that, but that's just an amazing idea.
Mm-hmm. So if you're looking to think big thoughts and learn something new or stretch yourself or any of that good stuff, we took a trip to the fourth floor this time for nonfiction books about science.
Although I'd like to point out real quick that Jamie and I did audiobooks, and those can be found on the third floor.
Yeah, you're right. It's not all fourth floor.
Yeah.
Science fiction, of course, is on the third floor. I'll put that out there. For our science-themed summer reading club, our space-themed summer reading club, we hope you come by and enter yourself in a couple of contests or spin the wheel and get a couple of prizes. Bring the kids, bring the teens. They've got sign-ups too. All right, that was Minor Rex, and we'll see you next time.